Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your co-hosts are Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor, and Pastor Charles Roberts.
Thanks for joining us again for this episode of the Out of the Question podcast. There's a song that came from the musical The King and I, and part of the lines within it, you know, when you're a teacher, by your students you were taught. Well, I have the privilege of completing my third year of dealing with a group of 11 young people from around the world. And at the end of every semester, they have to present a thesis. And the thesis has to do with things we learned throughout the year. And they have to incorporate the thinking and the worldview into it. And so I've been blessed to see how well they have absorbed the material. And one student gave a thesis presentation on the subject of poverty. And it got me thinking, I wonder how many people understand what this young lady has studied and communicated in her presentation. So I thought this would be a good topic for our podcast today. Now, statist education fosters an entitlement mentality, chronicling the past with a decided socialistic humanistic bias, encouraging a mentality of statist welfare as the solution to the problems of the poor. Could the problem of poverty have more to do with an educational system that doesn't foster or encourage work and productivity, but encourages passing tests that will be graded by an elite group of people? To quote Christian author Dennis Peacock, poverty has nothing to do with money. It has to do with skills and just opportunities. This means that if you have skills that can make you money, you should use them or spend your time acquiring skills that will help you do so. Today, Charles and I will be delving into the question, is the solution to poverty work? Any opening thoughts, Charles?
Well, like several of these questions that we entertain, the answer is sic et non, yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, in God's plan, the Lord commanded Adam in the garden to keep the garden, to cultivate it, to have dominion over it. And that involves work and labor. Of course, the character of work and labor changed dramatically for human beings following the fall. But in order to survive or flourish, this is what Adam's charge was. I think sometimes because of Renaissance art or science fiction movie, I don't know, people conjure up these images of the Garden of Eden as this perfect paradise, which it was, but it, nevertheless, it evidently needed cultivating and tending because this is what the Lord told Adam to do. On the other hand, I think the key factor, as you quoted Mr. Peacock, that long before there's any physical labor or paychecks issued, the mindset, the mentality, the spiritual orientation of a person is going to determine a great deal as to how they prosper or do not prosper in this life and in this world.
Right. And I do think you're correct that people have this ridiculous, and I mean ridiculous, view of the Garden of Eden. Sure, Adam and Eve were created sinless, but there were not instruction manuals hanging around as to how to build a house. And I have every reason to believe that Adam learned a lot by trial and error, and that the whole purpose of the Garden of Eden was a pilot project so that as they were fruitful and multiplied and replenished the earth, that they would have skills and experience in doing so. And people often ask the question, well, why would Adam and Eve be dissatisfied with anything? Why would they even listen to the serpent? And I think it's fair to say, from my own experience and that of others, that work is hard and is tiring. And sometimes you don't succeed at first. So quite possibly Adam and Eve were looking for the shortcut, and the proposition of the serpent was, you don't have to do it the way God said to do it. here's a better way. You decide how you want to do it. And of course, that plunged the world into sin. But it also gave people this idea that since the curse that was, you know, given to Adam and Eve, it didn't curse the idea of work. It meant that as he worked, his fallen nature would be an encumbrance. But too many people think of work as the fall, and they're not the same thing.
No, and I think that people have an idea, too, that if any and everybody just, quote, worked hard enough, then there would be no poor. Everyone would have enough money. Now, we know there are all kinds of circumstances that are involved in that. But I think at root, it is a spiritual issue. Whether people like it, some people like it or not, the reality is, if you look across the earth and throughout history, there have been cultures and civilizations that flourished, that were prosperous, and there have been others that never got beyond the stage of what we might call, you know, very primitive, barbaric existence. You know, there's been a lot in the news lately about South African refugees coming to this country, and that's been a flashpoint of controversy. You and I both either have known or spoken to, I think, a couple of individuals that were born and raised in South Africa, and whether you have or not, you can research the history, and you find that in the regions where the Europeans settled that part of Africa and the southern part of Africa, there really was nothing like agriculture that had ever taken place. So the difference is that you have a group of people, and it's not because of race, it's because of their covenantal understanding of who God is and who they are. And God has a covenant with his people, and part of that is to carry forth the dominion mandate that Adam was to carry forth and that has been renewed and given to us in Christ. And so if you have people from a pagan culture, regardless of where on earth it is, they're likely not going to flourish in the same way that those who are grounded in a biblical culture and a biblical perspective.
Exactly. And I think this is a good time to talk about, how are we going to define the poor? If we use a humanistic standard, then we're going to look at the prosperity index, you might say, of a culture. And let's say the difference between being poor in America and being poor in India. I'm just picking India because it's far away from America. In India, do all people measure their participation as in the group of the poor based on if they have a cell phone, based on if they have a car, based on if they can eat out at fast food restaurants? These are things that a lot of people in America would say, well, these are just minimum things that you need or that you should have the opportunity to have. But is that really a biblical way to look at who classifies as the poor?
I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to share something with you and our listeners that I came across a number of years ago. It was a public lecture being given by Lou Rockwell of lewrockwell.com and the Mises Institute, and an organization that I think in his earliest years, Dr. Rushdoony had some association with some of the people who were involved in the founding of that. And what was it, the Foundation for Economic Freedom, I think it was. But at any rate, Lou Rockwell was talking about this very issue, and I think he gave this lecture in 2012, somewhere in that time frame. And it was talking about he was referring to a census that had been taken that supposedly showed a large increase in the poverty rate and the largest increase in 20 years, it said. And then he made this statement, and I think you'll see where this connects with what you just said. Lou Rockwell said, but most people hear this and dismiss it probably for good reasons. The poor in this country are not poor by any historic standards. They have cell phones, cable TVs, cars, lots of food, and plenty of disposable income. What's more, there is no such thing as a fixed class called the poor. People come and go depending on age and life circumstances. Plus, in American politics, when you hear kvetching about the poor, everyone knows what you're supposed to do. Hand the government your wallet. So that's an important point, and I had not thought about that till I heard him, by means of audio, give that lecture. Yeah, I mean, you notice this, whether it's the tent cities, around San Francisco or wherever, or New York City or Philadelphia, some of these folks have cell phones, and they're able to get food to survive. And like he's saying, there's no permanent caste or class of people. Any of these people can have the opportunity, other things being equal, to move out of that category. That's not the case, I think, in places like you mentioned, like India, for example.
Right. So you think about it. The average person who gets a statist education, if he doesn't drop out, is there for 12 to 13 years. And then, if they buy into the whole idea that they have to go to college in order to be productive, have been fed a steady diet of, for example, the crimes against humanity of Western civilization. And so the whole idea of American slavery, which you don't have to approve of, to also recognize that slavery was not unique to the United States and it hasn't been abolished worldwide. As a matter of fact, there's a case for the fact that there are more slaves in the United States today than before the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, how could I say that? Well, post the war between the states, there was no Federal Reserve, there was no income tax, and employers were not bound to be employees of the government to collect taxes, and if they didn't, at their peril. So, by and large, even though people like to say, thank God we live in a free country, economically, we're not free. How ridiculous is it that you buy a house, you pay it off, but it really isn't your house because you're paying rent to a government that says you owe us taxes? So, by making slavery the only thing that we're going to look at it in terms of American slavery, really fosters this idea of who are the beneficiaries of things. And there's this sense of dissatisfaction. So the whole idea of work would, going back to Dennis Peacock's definition, that if you want to get rid of poverty, you have to acquire skills and look for opportunities. Just like the kid who, wants to buy a new pair of whatever, and his parents say, earn it. And so he opens up a lemonade stand because he's going to make money, or he decides he's going to mow people's lawns. This is a person who has a skill. He can make lemonade or he can push a lawnmower. And then, as a result of seizing and seeking out opportunities, he gets what he wants. But that's not the mindset, is it, in terms of welfareism?
No, and as alluded in that quote that I gave, it's the state that steps in and claims to be able to solve all these problems by taking money away from people who are not in poverty, so-called, and they are earning money and earning a living to whether it's buying the latest pair of $200 tennis shoes or simply provide for a family. I think it's interesting and worth contrasting some of the examples of people who are, whether we would say poverty-stricken or down and out in the times of Jesus. And certainly the issue of the poor is a big issue in the Bible. The poor are frequently referred to in various, like Psalms, Proverbs. Jesus interacted with a number of individuals that I think would qualify as being in poverty. And it's interesting to consider, of course, that's a different culture, a different time, a different place where I think there would have been more what we would understand, and as that quote referred to, sort of a permanent underclass of people, that this is where they were and they probably would not get to be anything else. And I know in the case of some of the people that Jesus interacted with, that some of them had serious medical problems.
Right.
And the same can be true today, but I think it's worth asking, what is it that actually constitutes poverty? I can think of an example of an individual that I knew very, very well. And this is a man who had a fairly, I'll say, disadvantaged upbringing. And he sort of was a hustler much of his life, selling various types of things, involved in sales jobs and various types of things like that. But he also had a very severe alcohol problem. And there were several times in this person's life where he had nothing, lived out of homes that were federally or county funded for people who had alcohol, who were alcoholics. But there came a point in this individual's life where he realized, and actually he it was through the ministry of the church that he joined and being around Christians who understood, had some fundamental understanding of the biblical teaching about how you should live your life to glorify God. He not only managed to come out of the circumstances he was in, he actually created and established a landscaping business and had two or three employees before he died. But there was, if you could, rewind to maybe 20 or 30 years earlier, this guy would have been considered just a bum and not really going to amount to anything. But the opportunities were there. But the more important thing was the spiritual motivation to recognize that he had a responsibility before God as to how he was going to live his life.
Exactly. Now, Paul says if a person doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. But it's not a blanket statement that, for example, would disqualify a widow getting assistance, or as you put it, somebody with medical problems. But the truth is, everybody can do something that would benefit the community. No, they may not be able to dig a ditch or build a house or go out and, get a sales job, as you just pointed out. But there are things that people can always do. And again, if you destroy the family, then the only thing that's left is the state to pick up the slack. But I know many families that have incorporated care for an elderly parent or grandparent or great-grandparent. And even if it's just in terms of the occasional meal that's made or stories, reading to children or whatever, you destroy the family and you create poor because people then are not told and live out their instruction to care for their own.
Yeah, I think one of the most striking things that came out of Dr. Rustin's interview, Bill Moyers, on the PBS documentary from back in the 1980s, was when Moyers was reviewing the various things relating to capital punishment according to God's law. And Dr. Rustin pointed out that in almost every case, the crime involved treason to the family. And how the idea of treason to the state is something totally unknown in the Bible. It's the family that is the foundation of everything. And where there is treason to the family, there are negative ramifications and results. And I think that's another thing, and I'm glad you mentioned this as far as the family, where there has been treasonous activity against the family, and that can take a lot of forms, it can lead to someone being poverty-stricken, spiritually and physically. Because if they aren't given the proper instruction and guidance within the family about how to live and what there is expected of them by God and what it means to glorify God in life, then they're starting off at a very great disadvantage in terms of their relationship to God and prospering in a way that glorifies Him. However, something will step in and say, okay, this is how you are to prosper. And that something, as you indicated, is the state. It will say, this is how we want you to behave. This is how we want you to live. This is how you make money. And by the way, you need to give us some of it. So there's an unavoidability of having a standard by which a family is to be lived and governed, and how the people in that family will move out from it and live their lives.
An example of what you were referencing years ago, I used to belong to an athletic club and I would go swimming regularly and I'd have an opportunity to talk to a woman there. And one day we had a conversation and I think one of her children was getting married and her stress was whether her son, who was purposely homeless, and by that I mean there was a room in her house that she was willing to let him use if he wouldn't take drugs. But he wouldn't do that, so she wasn't about to have him in her house. And I found out the guy had gone to MIT. And it was like, this is not a person who couldn't have had useful skills, even if he didn't use his MIT classes or learning that he got. But there was this refusal. And she says, I keep calling him. I said, well, how do you call him if he's homeless? She says, because the state provides a cell phone for him. And so he had resources that made it so that he didn't have to work. And so, how many people would drive by such an individual who might be standing there with a sign and say, "Poor guy"? Except, is he a poor guy? Except in the deficit he has in terms of being a man and being responsible and being a functioning member of the community? No. So all of us have been programmed, whether it's by media or by political verbiage, to think that there are people who are poor the same way that somebody walks into a poison oak bush or a poison ivy bush and they get poison oak or poison ivy. That's not how poverty happens.
Well, let me ask you personally, do you have any memory from where you grew up in your earlier years of people that you were told about who were, or they're poor, or was there a part of town that was considered a particularly poverty-stricken area?
Not that I remember. I definitely don't remember that. And yet you're right, the Bible references the poor. In fact, Jesus says, you'll always have the poor with you. But interestingly enough, he doesn't qualify what it means in that particular statement to be poor. But I think he's referencing the fact that built into scripture is a remedy in terms of the poor. But I don't know about you. Did you grow up and have poor sections of towns where people were living on the street?
I never saw anyone living on the street. There were sections in the city and where I grew up that were very low income, and I think probably by even 1950s and early 60s standards would have been considered poverty stricken. Now, just in terms of the times, at least one or two of those areas were inhabited by a lot of African American folks. However, our neighborhood, which was a lower middle class white suburban neighborhood, we occasionally, I won't say frequently, but occasionally, we had men, almost always men, who would come through the neighborhood wanting to earn some money. And can I rake your yard? Can I do some yard work for you to earn some income? And these were people who, to appearances at least, looked like they could use some help financially. Of course, the bigger question is, why? What is the circumstance? But I remember there was one guy in particular came to our house. I must have been, I don't know, 10 years old at the time, but I was so stricken by what appeared to be the unfortunate nature of this man's life. I was moved to tears and I begged my mother to give him something to do, And I've never forgotten that. I'm not saying I'm a saint by any means, but it's always been an issue because the Bible speaks about it. And I remember in the first church that I served after I was ordained, I wondered to the folks that were there, the church had been around for a number of years, about what kind of ministry they had to people who were poor, who might reach out for food and assistance. I don't remember if they had much of anything, but I asked around and I found a ministry that was very unique in that their philosophy was, we don't want to help people in their poverty, we want to help them out of it. And that struck me as a very, very, very biblical way and better way to look at it than somebody, okay, you need some food, you need some canned goods, here it is, God bless you, we hope you have a better day.
Right. So the Bible's provision for the poor is wrapped up in one of the three tithes that the Bible prescribes. So the poor tithe, since it, think in terms of the Bible works in 7-year cycles. 6 years you work, the seventh is a sabbatical year. And things are organized according to that. So the Levitical tithe, which would be the first tithe, was supposed to be administered every year, as was the rejoicing tithe, where you would rejoice before the Lord. So built into God's economy is, I want you to have time to enjoy yourself and rejoice before the Lord. And I imagine a lot of people at the time in Israel would go to Jerusalem for the feasts, and they would feast. The word feast is a lot different than just eat. It was feast, right? But then in the third and the sixth year, there was the poor tithe. And the poor tithe was meant to help those people who had a run of circumstances that put them at a disadvantage. And it was very much a face-to-face relationship. So you would help. You had been set aside, you had been setting aside money for this poor tithe, and then you would bring it, and whether it was administered through the local Levite or directly by you, you knew the person you were helping. And that person would take the resources that were given in this poor tithe, and the whole purpose was to help that person and his family move out of the situation where they needed help. The goal was to have them become contributing members of society or of their community. I don't know that the term society was in vogue, the community, and that they would then be able to be employed or have a business, and they would be able to help others. So the goal, as you put it, of that one church was that you no longer classify yourself as being poor, because whether it was help financially or training or something, so that you had a skill. Now, we don't have that now, but over the years, my husband and I have, you know, how do we do this? Well, a couple of times we ran into a couple that was in fellowship with us, but they were struggling. And so instead of just giving them a handout, we knew that this, the husband of the couple, had a bunch of books that he was no longer using. I didn't really need the books, but I bought the books from him, knowing that at some point I could give them or share them with someone else. For his wife, she could sew. And I was like, I would love you to make some dresses for my daughter. Okay. Well, the truth is, I spent way more with the material and her doing it and compensating her for her time. But she didn't walk away as if I don't have some, I mean, I'm just a poor person, or I don't want to accept charity. Well, there are times to accept charity, but there are also times that you can help somebody develop an idea. Well, maybe I could make some money sewing, or maybe I could do this or that. So there are ways that, like your mother, who then would hire the man looking for work to rake leaves or whatever, we can do that. And even originally, Salvation Army Goodwill Industries were all about having opportunities for people to work so they could move themselves out of poverty classification.
Yeah, and I think one of the key elements you is what something you just mentioned about the face-to-face interaction, and the various tithe structures that you mentioned in God's law, to a greater or lesser extent, the whole pattern of how the Lord ordained society, godly society, to function, was followed largely in Western Christian civilization, not always perfectly. But the biblical pattern was the foundation for how people were dealt with and interacted with. I'd like to share an example of another church that I served that was in a little different physical location and situation than the circumstance I mentioned earlier. And this place had a pretty sizable, what they called a food closet. And when I got to that church, they didn't really have as well-defined policy about the distribution of food to those who may call and ask for it. So we had some discussion, the session, the elders and I and the deacons, and what we came up with was that anyone who calls the church for assistance or stops by, we will give them food or clothing if we have it, no questions asked. But if they call again, or if they come back a second time, we make it clear to them, you are, by doing this, giving us the right to get involved with you, to ask you some questions about how you got into this circumstance. And just so you know, we want to help you so you don't have to be doing this. And I know of one case where two of the deacons went to the home of someone who couldn't come to pick up the food. And when they got there, they had like three satellite dishes, four or five dogs. I mean, it's like, well, we know where your money's going right now. It's going to the cable TV company and to the dog food place. You know, and then so again, because these folks had been involved in having benefits from taking food from our church, which, you know, we were happy to give it, but we also made it clear, you now have a responsibility to be accountable to us if we're going to have this kind of relationship. And so that worked reasonably well, and at least gave people the notice that you have a responsibility before God to live in such a way that you don't have to beg off of people. And like you're saying, here's an example for you to follow where you can help somebody else so they don't have to do that if they're in that circumstance.
Exactly. You look at what happens in a lot of third world countries in terms of development. People go in there And they find out that, you know, the women can sew. So they, with the money that has been donated, they'll buy them sewing machines so that they can use those sewing machines, have a business, etc. So the whole theme or the outlook of scripture is to make it so that you won't have poor among you, or you'll have less poor among you. And I wonder how many in the body of Christ look at becoming an employer or a business owner that can provide work for the willing. In other words, there'll be plenty of people who just want the handouts because right now handouts are quite prevalent. But if people were to actually have a way that they would have a business where they could vet people and make sure that here are the terms on which you work here. You can't work here and get welfare at the same time. We're not interested in you cheating one system one way or the other, but we'll train you. And we might even then have a provision where you could be hired. So you go from probation or a probationary period and actually that. Now, here's a question. What would happen if status welfareism was cut off tomorrow? What way would that vacuum be filled? And it's a perfect opportunity for the church to think in those terms because welfareism, status welfareism, is unbiblical. So as long as we have something that's unbiblical, we cannot expect God's blessing. But by the same token, as is mentioned in the book of Exodus, God didn't clear out everybody because if he had cleared out all the enemies, then the animals would take over and eat all the vegetation. So God will give us dominion to the degree we're ready to take it. And I wonder how many places are focused on that. And I don't mean let's get our church to do a program. I'm talking about individual families, individual business owners, because the admonition to help those who are poor is not something that the elders are supposed to do. I can sit back. Hey, we're paying the elders. They're supposed to do everything God says to do.
Yeah, and as you just said, that's not the pattern because the focal point for the activity and the successful carrying forward of the plan that God has ordained is the family. And so that's another key. I think that's an important part that the church can play is making sure that the families who are a part of the church have proper instruction and understanding about this is what you should be teaching your children. This is how we are to be thinking about this whole issue. If the state welfare system suddenly collapsed and there was nothing available, well, those people who were dependent on it would sink or swim pretty quick. And the swim part of that, they would probably be looking to other sources for assistance and help, which is understandable to some extent. And as I've mentioned earlier, historically, the source of help for those who are genuinely poor and down and out has been the church in some form or other, you know, whether it be in the, I don't know, prior to the high Middle Ages in the late AD 600 and 800 timeframe, I'm just kind of guessing here, with the rise of monasteries in different parts of Europe. I mean, the monks would be the ones who farmed land and helped out people. This is a Christian pattern. We can debate the theology behind it, but anyone in listening to us, if you happen to live near a functioning monastery today, there's still some of that goes on. When I was in New York, there was an Eastern Orthodox monastery that's very well known in that part of the country in the Northeast. They had two means of supporting themselves. One was training dogs, and the other one, they made cheesecakes that you would just about jump over a cliff to get. They were just unbelievably good. And other places do other things. You know, those are just two kind of funny examples, but that's what they were doing. And that's a remnant of that earlier model before, you know, corruption set in, the church became distorted, and the biblical foundation was gone. And then so the state steps in and takes over these things. I want to give one other example of something that happened during a number of years ago when I was still in seminary. My wife and I and our younger daughter were visiting the church which we were members of, which we didn't often get to go to because I was out of town at seminary, but we happened to be there. And my daughter was quite young and needed to be taken out of the sanctuary. And so we went into the narthex. This was a pretty large church in the downtown area of the city where I lived. And one of the men who was an elder at that church I knew, he was standing back there during the service. I think it was the evening service. So I was back there chatting with him and my, my infant daughter in my arms, and the door opened up, and in walked this family of, I think it was two adults and a couple of kids. And there had been some horrific hurricane in Florida that particular year or month or whenever it was. And it was well known that this had devastated different parts of South Florida. And so they said they were refugees. I don't know if they use that term, but that they were heading further north. They'd lost everything, and they just wondered if the church could help out. What was interesting about that is that about 2 or 3 months later, this same church had some representatives from this ministry I referred to a while ago about helping you out of your poverty instead of helping you in it. And they came and made a presentation to the board of deacons of this church. And I'll never forget the woman making the presentation talked about how they functioned as a ministry to help churches qualify. Who is it when they come to you asking for aid, food, money, whatever? Who can help you qualify whether these people really deserve it and are needful of it? And they were functioning as that sort of clearinghouse to find out if other churches reported different things. She said, for example, there was a couple who were going around town just a few weeks ago claiming to be from South Florida and asking for help. And they weren't from South Florida at all. As a matter of fact, the car they were driving was stolen. So it had been that very couple that I myself and the other guy had encountered who came in that day. So, I mean, and this is all within the auspices of the church that this information was passed around and people were made aware. So the biblical pattern is one, of course, that is ignored by the state. It comes up with its own qualifications for what allows you to receive a subsistence. But the main goal is to keep people addicted to the state and its support rather than following the biblical pattern of self-support and support within the family structure.
Right. The war on poverty has been about as successful as the war on drugs.
Right.
So it must be big business to war in certain areas for some people. But I remember in Dr. Rush Juni's lecture series on American history up till 1860, I think that's the name of the series,
Right.
he spoke in terms of the volunteerism that made America flourish. And by that, he gave some examples. For like a case in the San Francisco area, people would come in as immigrants, and Christian women would meet them because the women of the families would have to know, okay, our climate here is different than where you came from. These are the foods that are available. These are the vegetables that you can grow. We can help you. In many cases, they help them learn English. Now, today, we would expect, well, there's got to be some agency, some NGO that does that. Well, we know now a lot about NGOs and how they don't really help the people they purport to, but individual families took that responsibility on. And no doubt they became friends. And as the children grew, they didn't have animosity for other ethnic groups because these groups had helped them, but they didn't even look at them as groups. These were the Christian people who were willing to help. And it's no surprise that things like orphanages and hospitals, these are things that were started by Christians. I don't believe you find them in history, other places where the admonition to help those in need is as strong, if at all exists at all, in terms of the biblical pattern and mandates.
Absolutely not. And one of the places you definitely did not find it was in the Greek-speaking Roman world of the days of Jesus and the apostles. And we see reference in the Gospels to people who have leprosy. Of course, God's word early on talked about various types of diseases and how they're to be treated and how to prevent its spread. And some of that subsisted even into Jesus' day. But the modern phenomenon of helping people who have medical issues or sickness, that is exclusively, I think, a Christian phenomenon from people who take that word seriously. So I guess in terms of moving toward a conclusion about all this, what would you say, Andrea, would be the key thing for people to take away in terms of what is the real nature of poverty and what it means to be poor?
I really do like Dennis Peacock's definition, but we always have to put it within context. I mean, the average person today is richer than King Solomon was. King Solomon didn't have the ability to get on a plane and go visit other countries. He didn't have the computer technological resources, if he had a question, to immediately go and get some insight. All right. So, first of all, we have to recognize that God has blessed our 21st century with opportunities that people in the past did not have. But if you're going to evaluate true poverty, you have to contextualize it. And I think that's the takeaway from this. Don't figure that anybody who's classified as poor meets the definition of someone who can't work or someone person has no skills. Oftentimes, the whole immigration issue is clumped together with the issue of poverty, with the assumption that everybody who comes to the United States is poor and they're just coming for a better life. Well, I have ancestors who came to America because they wanted opportunities, but none of them thought that they were going to come and get a handout. They either came with a skill or they apprenticed in order to get a skill. So we have to remember there is a theology of work, and work is built into the commandment that says, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, and then the seventh is a day of rest. So we call that the Sabbath rest commandment. We could also refer to it as the 6 day work week. And so, as you understand biblical law better, and I'm specifically now talking to families and individuals, and then the community of believers who come together as individuals and families who meet and interact regularly, is to have a philosophy of how do we truly help someone understand their responsibility before God to work? It's not like it's an option. Right? You can't rest one day in seven unless you're working the other 6 days. And so, as we become more proficient in biblical law, we will see opportunities to say, okay, I know how I could help that person. Minimum wage laws, for example, do more to encourage poverty than to ever have it end. Because not everybody, I know in California now, I think the minimum wage is like $17. Not everybody's worth $17. Well, how do we get around that? Well, maybe somebody comes and works for you and they get a handful of groceries. No need for taxes, no need for anything like that. You just help them with food and then whatever they can do elsewhere. So I think we need to be creative in terms of we know we're supposed to help those who are truly poor so that we start set aside some money to fulfill that poor tithe so it's available when God brings someone to us. So that would be my takeaway. I don't know if you think that there's more to add.
Only that, as we said from the very beginning, is poverty and being poor is not just a situation of not having something to do, not having work to do. It starts much further back in an attitude, a mindset, a recognition of who we are. I mean, in one sense, we're all poor. We're born into the world by God's grace where we need His direction and guidance. So the poor in spirit, for example. But the key thing there is the recognition that we are dependent upon Almighty God for our salvation, for everything in life. And it is He who describes for us and tells us what prosperity means, what work is, and if there is poverty, how we are delivered from it. And the very things that you mentioned fall into those categories. So I guess just in closing, I would encourage our listeners to go to the calcedon.edu website and click on the resources tab and just type in the word poverty or poor, and you'll find a whole host of articles and book references to various things that Dr. Rushdoony and others associated with the ministry over the years have written on this topic.
Right. One book that is a book that Dr. Rushdoony said it was his most unpopular book and it had the fewest sales. Well, what was the title? Tithing and
And
Dominion.
Dominion, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So why don't people like that idea? Well, you know what? If somebody else will do it, let's let them do it. But if we fail to recognize that we have an obligation before God to do these things, then a book like Tithing and dominion will be very useful. So I would definitely encourage that. And I even think there may be some lectures. The resources section, when you put in a topic, there's a filter. And if you want to read something in an article or a magazine article, you check that box. If you want to listen to a lecture, you check that box. And either way, you're going to get a framework for how to obey God in this area.
Yeah, very good. Thanks for mentioning that. And for myself, I hope that this has been an enriching presentation for our listeners.
There you go. All right, folks. outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com is how you reach us. And we look forward to talking with you next time.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit chalcedon.edu.